You're listening to Reality Sandwich Radio, where every Thursday at noon we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, body, spirit, and our planet, community, and economy. To learn more about the Healthful Living model, go to healthfulliving.org. Reality Sandwich is hosted by Julie Matthews, Certified Nutrition Consultant, and Martin Matthews, Certified Medical Hypnotherapist. Past episodes of Reality Sandwich are available for free download at realitysandwichradio.com. Thanks for listening.
And for those of you just tuning in, it's going to be speaking with Liz Lipsky. She is a PhD and a CCN who holds a doctorate in clinical nutrition and is a board-certified clinical nutritionist. Dr. Lipsky has worked in the field of holistic and complementary medicine for over 25 years and is the author of Digestive Wellness and Leaky Gut Syndrome. Dr. Lipsky is currently in private practice in Asheville, North Carolina. So let me see if I can get Liz on the line. 1 minute. Liz, are you there?
I am.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm very good. I'm thrilled to have you.
It's going to be fun.
And I have to say, sort of a strange set of coincidence. I have heard the name Asheville, North Carolina, 4 times in the last 2 months. So something is up with that. I hear it's an incredibly beautiful place.
It is a beautiful place. I'm looking out my window at a little mountain, and I can see the trees, and we're a very cosmopolitan little town in the middle of national forests and mountains, so it's very pretty.
Nice. Well, today we get to talk about my favorite subject, which is digestion, and not only digestion, but digestion for children. So, firstly, I just wanted to introduce for people that are just joining us your new book, Digestive Wellness for Children, How to Strengthen the Immune System and Prevent Disease Through Healthy Digestion. And boy, is this an important subject these days. Maybe you can just start with telling us, you know, digestion is one of those things we often, we don't think too much about. And it's just kind of is what it is. Nobody ever wants to ask about how other people's digestion is or what normal digestion is. And so firstly, let's just start out by why should we care about digestive wellness? Why is it so important?
If digestion doesn't work well, nothing works well. Because the reason that we eat is to nourish our cells. And so if the nutrients can't get to the cells, then we feel tired, we have brain fog, our kids misbehave, and nothing really works right. And Julie, when I was going to meetings in the mid-1990s, every nutrition and medical meeting I was going to was focusing on the digestive system. And the more I know about it, the more fascinating it is, because two-thirds of our immune system is in our gut. And the reason for that is that every day we're taking in pounds of food and saying, I want to be just like you. And the immune system has to decide, do I really want to be just like you, or do I really not want to be just like you? Do I want to be like this soft drink that you just ate, or these crackers that had trans fat, or do I want to be like this apple or this carrot? Do I really want these pesticides here? And so the immune system is really located in the gut. And what we're seeing in adults and children, so many more autoimmune or quirky kind of health conditions that we don't really know what they're about. Also, we make more neurotransmitters in our gut than we do in our brain. And so there's this brain-gut connection, and when our digestive system doesn't work well, we can't think right or behave right in the case of children and sometimes adults, who I get to borrow from an airline, who act like children. And then also, we have more nerve endings in our gut than we have in our spine. And so it's a very important part of our nervous system as well. So when somebody says, you know, every time I'm nervous, my stomach feels really bad or I get diarrhea. And so what's fascinating is that the gut and the digestive system is related to every single part. We also have so many different hormones in our gut as well. And so it's really a fascinating system, and yet most people don't even think about it unless it's not working right. And most people don't even consider that some other kind of non-seemingly related health issue might even have something to do with digestion, but often it does.
Wow, that was a really that certainly answered my question on why we should care. Those are so many factors that I see in my practice in terms of for those people that are new to the show. I work a lot with children, pregnant moms, and babies, but as well, I work a lot with autism, and the digestive issues play a significant role. It's amazing that a majority of them, if not maybe even all of them, I could say, have some digestive imbalance to be working with. And with the gut being sort of the second brain, it's not surprising that you see these gut issues manifesting in behavioral and cognitive ways. Well, talk about the standard American diet here. Maybe describe it a little to people. And then how does this diet that we've adopted affect our digestive wellness?
Well, let's talk about the standard diet. First of all, the average person, conservatively speaking, eats about half of their calories every day in white sugar, white flour, other processed foods. Adults drink alcohol. And what happens is that the reason why we eat, as I said before, is it's to get nutrients to the cells. So if we're eating foods that don't have many nutrients in them, then we're going to be robbing our nutritional bank accounts, and we're not going to have all the nutrients that we need. And nutrients are so important. For example, magnesium is deficient. Different estimates vary from anywhere between 50 and 75% of the population is magnesium deficient, because we find it in whole grains, things like brown rice and quinoa and barley and buckwheat and millet. And we also find it in green leafy vegetables like kale and chard and spinach and collard greens. And most people don't eat very much of either of those.
Mm-hmm.
And magnesium alone is responsible for over 200 different chemical reactions in the body. So when we don't have enough magnesium, we get really irritable, we get constipated, we have twitching, muscle cramping. You know, so every nutrient has different signature, and they're all so important. And the standard American diet, which is, as I said, mostly processed, refined foods, and also half of the foods that we eat aren't eaten at home. They're eaten on the run in restaurants and fast food restaurants where the foods are also dead.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have much enzyme activity. They don't have good beneficial bacteria in them. All the things that give us life, the foods that give us life are the live foods, and we're not getting those in the standard American diet. So what happens is that over time we kind of run down. And we're designed to fail anyway in about 100 years, but some of us start running down really early, and you see, and I see in my practice, so many babies and children, and it doesn't just start later in life. We're starting to see children who are sicker and sicker, and it's really of concern. It's really of great concern. I've been saying for a long time, you know, when I was a kid, I'm a baby boomer, and fat frozen foods were the big deal. McDonald's was something brand new. I think a McDonald's burger cost 10 cents or 12 cents. And the whole idea of frozen orange juice and TV dinners and tater tots, well, that was revolutionary. And then come along the 60s and 70s, and we start getting microwave ovens in the 1970s. And in the 1980s, we start getting irradiated foods. And then in the 1990s, we start getting genetically engineered foods. And foods today are not what they used to be. I was working with a couple yesterday, and they have a 4-year-old and a 10-year-old. And they live also with her parents. And her parents keep saying, why do we have to buy organic milk? And why do we have to spend so much on organic foods? And she had a really great answer. She said, you know, Dad, I want my kids to be able to eat the same quality foods you grew up on.
Mm.
I thought that was brilliant.
Yes, absolutely. So can you take us through a kind of a short tour? This is one of the things I love about your books, that you kind of go through the beginning to the end of the digestive process and kind of paint a picture of how all the different organs are involved. Can you give us a short tour?
Sure, I'd love to. One of my favorite tours. Basically, digestion begins in the mouth. And honestly, it starts even before that, because if we look at something or our children look at something and they get, ew, they're not going to eat it, and we're not going to. If it doesn't smell good or it doesn't look right, we're not going to eat it. So that's our first defense, really, against spoiled food or bad food. And then when we put it in our mouth, that's our second defense, because if it doesn't taste right, how many times have we put something in our mouth and we go, this doesn't taste exactly right, and you either spit it out or say, I'm not eating more of this. So in the mouth, we also have enzymes. And they start breaking down mostly carbohydrate and a little bit of fat. And so the process of actually chewing our food is also really important. It's kind of a lost art, I think, for many of us. But chewing the food until it's really liquidy helps break it down so that it's a mush, so that the rest of our digestive system doesn't have to work so hard. And so then when we swallow the food, it goes down in through the esophagus, and it goes down into the stomach. And in the stomach, we have hydrochloric acid. And that acid is strong enough that if you actually put it on your skin, it would burn your skin. And it would make a little burn there. And what we use that acid for is pretty interesting. We use it again to protect us against parasites and infections and viruses and bacteria that might be in the food. So it's our third protection against food poisoning. First looking at it, then tasting it, and then if we still made it through, the hydrochloric acid should take care of it. The hydrochloric acid also allows us to break down protein, and we start breaking protein that can be as much as 25,000 amino acids long. We start breaking them down into smaller pieces so that we can digest them. And that happens in the stomach. Once the food is digested enough in the stomach and it's liquidy enough, then it passes into the small intestine. And the small intestine is about 22 feet long in adults, and it's like a big hose. And what we do in the small intestine is we finish the job of digestion, but we also begin the job of absorption so that the food and nutrients can go into our bloodstream so that our cells can actually get them. And the first beginning part of the small intestine is called the duodenum, and it's about 12 to 18 inches long. And it's there that with the hydrochloric acid that we and our children start absorbing calcium, magnesium, zinc, iron, potassium. So many of our minerals get absorbed right there, and they need that acid to be able to be absorbed. Then the acid's done its job. After the first foot or two of the small intestine, the next 21 feet don't need that acid. So what happens is the pancreas secretes bicarbonate, which is basically like baking soda, to neutralize the acid, because its job is done. And the pancreas also pumps out pancreatic enzymes for fat, protein, and carbohydrates so that we can digest the food that we just ate all the way down to a molecular scale so that then we can absorb it into our bloodstream. The liver, at the same time, has been making bile, and it's been getting stored in the gallbladder. So if we eat a meal that has any fat in it, we'll dump some fat also, we'll dump some bile also into the beginning of the small intestine so that we can emulsify that fat so that the globules are really tiny so that the fat enzymes can actually digest it so that we can utilize it. So as the food travels through the small intestine, the process of digestion gets completed, and as nutrients are small enough, then they get absorbed actually into the bloodstream and picked up by the cells so that they can be used, so that we have energy and nutrients so that we can repair cells, that we can burn that energy, that glucose energy in our mitochondria so that we can run around all day. And then finally, we have the large intestine. And in the large intestine, what we do, well, right in between the small and the large intestine, we have a valve called the ileocecal valve, and hanging off of that is the appendix. And the appendix deals with immune functions. And they don't fully understand it, but my best belief about it is that what it's doing is saying, is also catching to say, well, I want to make sure that what passes from the small intestine to the large intestine is really finished and really clean. And so it produces some hormones and some enzymes and some different things to make sure that it all works pretty well, and also that materials can't back up from the large intestine back up into the small intestine. So in the large intestine, we finish the process of absorption, like vitamin B12 gets absorbed really in the large intestine mainly, and we also start reabsorbing water. Every day, we reabsorb gallons of water from our large intestine so that we don't have to drink as much. I know that it seems like we have to drink a lot of water, but we're absorbing sometimes 2 to 3 to 4 gallons of water that our body has been pumping through the gut.
Wow.
Yeah. And so we reabsorb that. And if we don't reabsorb that, then we have diarrhea. And if we absorb too much of it because the stool is sitting in our colon for too long, then we get those little balled up hard stools that are hard to pass.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that takes us all the way through. And then we poop out the waste and we're done.
All right. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
And speaking of, one of my most popular subjects among nutrition for kids, poop.
Poop. For adults, too, because nobody talks about it.
No, they don't. So guess what? We're going to talk about it here.
Oh, how fun.
So can you talk about what a healthy bowel movement would look like, you know, frequency and appearance, both for infants and children? And I guess while we're at it, we might as well throw adults in the mix.
Okay. So for infants, if they're breastfed, they have this little yellow, kind of sweet, cheesy-smelling poop. Do you have kids?
No, not yet.
Oh, well, you'll see. If you ask me, I can remember my kids' little first poops while they were completely breastfed. And it's normal for breastfed babies. They'll poop like once or twice a day. Some will go sometimes a couple days without having a bowel movement. Some will have 4 or 5 bowel movements in a day. It's really individual. It's really individual. But basically, breastfed babies, they have kind of a soft, creamy poop, and they're yellow. And they're yellow from the bile that they're producing, and they're very clean, and they don't smell bad. Then as you start giving a baby solid foods, you get those yucky poops like we get that are kind of stinky, and you go, oh, this is not a diaper I want to change. And basically, if our bodies are working right, whether we're babies, toddlers, or adults, what ought to happen is that we eat and then we poo. And so when my body's working really right, I wake up in the morning and I have a bowel movement, and then I have breakfast and I have a bowel movement, then I have lunch and then I have a bowel movement, and then maybe after dinner I have another one. So what's considered to be normal in medical terms is anywhere between 3 and 21 bowel movements a week, which means that what's considered medically normal is that if you're only having a bowel movement every 2 or 3 days, they don't worry about it. If my clients are only having a bowel movement every 2 or 3 days, I'm really worried about it. Because the longer our stool sits in our colon, the more it gets reabsorbed, and a lot of the waste that we were getting rid of get absorbed back into our bloodstream. And also, some of the hormones that we got rid of are also getting reabsorbed. And so when we're chronically constipated, the research is clearer for women, but we see a specific enzyme that shows up in stool analysis called beta-glucuronidase. And when that's really high, it says that this person has a higher risk of breast cancer in women or hormone-related cancers. And for men, the link isn't as clear, but we're starting to see a link with male hormone-related cancers like prostate cancer and testicular cancer. So having regular bowel movements is really important. And so for me, I think having anywhere between 1 to 3 or 4 bowel movements a day, as long as they're normal bowel movements, is a good idea. And what a normal bowel movement feels like and looks like is that you sit down on the toilet, and in about 30 seconds it whooshes out of you, and it looks kind of like a big, long banana. It's kind of solid. It's kind of semi-soft like a banana is, and it's tapered at one end, and it just kind of jumps out of you almost. It whooshes out. If you've got, and generally it will sink or float depending on, I know there's a lot about that, about where it should be, but it seems like it'll float more if you've had more oil and fat in your diet the day before, and it'll sink more maybe if you've had less. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to ask. So it's not necessarily that we need to, that if it floats or something, we're saying that the fat isn't digesting. It's just maybe the amount of fat in the diet?
It could be the amount of fat that your body just didn't take all of it in.
Got it.
So, and that it may not be digesting that well, but there's so many different theories. There are people who say it should always float. There are people who say it should never float. And so, I don't know, as long as it looks healthy.
Mm-hmm.
But if it has pieces of undigested food in it, that's not a good sign. If it has, I was talking to a client today, and she was telling me that before she went on a gluten-free diet, that her stools were pasty in color. They were light tan. Mm. When you see light tan stools, it means somebody's really not absorbing fat at all. And that's not a good sign. It's called steatorrhea. It's not a good sign, and it could indicate gallbladder problems or liver problems or, in her case, gluten intolerance. Mm. Our stools should not look like little balled-up things. They shouldn't be hard to pass. Mm-hmm. And they also shouldn't be really watery diarrhea. Sometimes it's okay if your stool kind of falls apart once it hits the toilet. That's not a horrible thing, but you don't want that to happen all the time. They should be kind of solid but soft.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably more than you wanted to know about poop. But, you know, one of the other really interesting things about it is that there's a self-test that people can do to see how long it takes for food to actually travel through their digestive system. What's considered to be optimal is somewhere between 18 and 24 hours, so that you eat something today and tomorrow it's gone. It's out of your body.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the average transit time for Americans is 72 hours.
Wow.
So what we ate today comes out 3 days later, even if we're having a bowel movement every day.
Wow.
And so one of the interesting things to do is to try to do a self-test on yourself to see, well, how long does it really take me?
Mm-hmm.
And there are some really easy ways to do that. If you like beets, eat a bunch of beets, because you'll see that purple-red color come out in your stool. And you want to look for the first time it comes out and the last time it comes out. Or you can use tomatoes, because tomato seeds aren't very digestible, or sesame seeds, or, you know, because they're light in color. And you can look and see, if you eat a tablespoon or two of seeds, you can look and see if they came out in your stool and when.
Mm-hmm.
You can also use charcoal, which will turn your stool very black. And those are my three favorite ways of kind of checking it.
Yeah, that's always a fun. That's one of that in your digestive wellness book, you describe that, and I definitely had fun sort of seeing what that is, because sometimes, like you said, if you have a bowel movement after each meal, you're not pooping out that meal. You're pooping out one that came sometime before that. So how long before, we don't know unless we do some sort of a little experiment.
Yeah.
So a couple other questions on that. Formula-fed babies, how does their stool differ from breastfed babies?
I don't have first-hand experience with that, because my kids never got any formula. So I can't tell you what they really look like. I don't make a habit of going around and looking in babies' diapers that often. My sense is that they would still be soft and pretty yellow. They do smell more than breastfed babies' poops do. But I haven't really looked that carefully.
Sure, sure. And then the other common one I get in my practice, especially my autism practice, is green stool. What can you say about that?
The green stool is probably, boy, I honestly don't know.
Okay.
I honestly don't know. It could be from undigested food, and it's just the green color from food. Or it could have something to do with the bile, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah. I had heard something that the stool is moving through too quickly, and I heard something about bile as well, but I couldn't really figure out how, if the yellow stool is bile, and then how it turned green, where you get, you know, where the colors mix together. But
well, I think what happens is that the bile does have a greenish color, and then as we concentrate it, as the stool sits in our colon for longer, then what happens is it gets concentrated, and that's what makes the brown color in our stool is the bile. And so in children who are small but are eating solid food, it's not going to stay yellow.
Mm-hmm.
It's only in those breastfed babies that we see that really yellow stool. So it probably has something to do with bile. Sometimes you can see even in an adult stool, you'll see that it's really green just because they were eating a lot of greens, or taking greens.
Sure. So what about fermented foods and probiotics? And again, one of the things I love in your books is that you really describe probiotics and all of the amazing benefits, from detoxification to, of course, digestion and immune function and all sorts of things. So if you could describe that a little, that would be great.
Well, I will. Probably the people who are listening already know about probiotics because they're getting a lot of press right now, which is very exciting. Because they used to be kind of a hidden piece. And in our, I don't know how much in children's guts, but in adults' guts, we have about 3 pounds of bacteria and fungi in our digestive system, in our small intestine and large intestine. It's an organ, really, the size of our liver. And when babies are born, they're born with sterile digestive tracts, and they don't have any good bugs in their tummy yet. And they start picking them up from baby bottle nipples, from putting their hands in their mouth, putting their toes in their mouth, from their mom's breast. They start picking up good beneficial bacteria, and if they come through the birth canal and have a natural childbirth, they're also picking them up as they're coming through the birth canal right from their mom's vagina. And the main probiotic bacteria that's in an infant's digestive system is one called Bifidobacteria infantis. And sometimes it's called Bifidobacteria lactis. I don't know why it has two names, but suddenly it does. And until a child is about 2, it's the main probiotic bacteria in their gut. And I've worked with babies who've had colic. And I just tell their moms to give them some Bifidus infantis.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it doesn't always happen within 24 hours, but sometimes within 24 hours, that baby is turning into a settled baby.
Mm.
And usually within 3 or 4 days, they're really settling down. As I say, it's not always true, but almost always that's what the baby really needs. Because these probiotic bacteria help set the stage for our immunity for our whole lives. And what we're finding out in the research now is that a lot of our whole life immunity gets set up in the first 4 or 5 years. And so breastfeeding is definitely best if you can't breastfeed, or even if you're breastfeeding but you have kind of funky digestion. It's really great to give your baby some Bifidus infantis because it helps regulate their digestion.
Mm-hmm.
A story that I had, my son's now 21, one of my sons, and he was my first child, and when he was about 10 days old, he started getting this horrible eczema diaper rash. Just horrible. And by the time he was 3 months old, I had tried everything short of cortisone, which I wasn't going to do. But I had done all kinds of heroic things, and nothing was really helping. And he looked like a little burn victim. He was had this eczema up above his belly button and all the way on his bottom. You know, it was just horrible. And I finally went to see a holistic MD, and she said, oh, we need to give him some Bifidobacteria infantis. And I'd never heard of it. And so I started giving him a little pinch. I would just take a pinch of it and put it on my hand and put a drop of water in it and make a little paste of it and put it on his tongue. And then since I was breastfeeding, I would take it a couple times a day as well. I'd take a quarter to half a teaspoon. Well, within 10 days, the rash was 100% gone.
Wow.
Not only the rash was 100% gone, all of those kind of pacing, rocking chair moments were also gone. And his cradle cap disappeared. So when my second son was born, I started him on it from day one, and we never had any of the same problems.
Wow, that's a great story.
Yeah, and so that was a great learning for me because probiotics, we didn't know much about them back then.
Mm-hmm.
We knew to eat yogurt. That was about all we knew.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as a child gets to be a toddler, then they also start getting a lot of lactobacilli. Of different strains. And so by the time they're about four, they've got a really good balance of lactobacilli and bifidobacteria, and the lactobacilli are mainly in the small intestine, the bifidobacteria mainly in the large intestine. And they do, as you were saying, they really protect us from so many different things. The probiotics make B-complex vitamins. They make also vitamin K, which is very important for blood coagulation. They protect us by making little bits of antibiotics. They also make little bits of anti-cancer substances. And they really protect us, and they're a very, very important part of our immune system.
And then, of course, the good bacteria, the probiotics, feed on certain foods that we call prebiotics, things that are found in onions and kefir and grains and things. Can you, I guess my question is this something people need to focus their attention on eating more of, or does it naturally mostly come through the food supply? And then along with that, is there any benefit to eating a naturally fermented food over a supplement because of the prebiotics?
You know, good question. So many of them. One, I think fermented foods are really important. Historically, people have always eaten fermented foods. So we have tempeh and miso and soy sauce from Japan. We have sauerkraut and other fermented vegetables that come from Europe. We have cultured milk, like we have kefir that comes from Russia, and we have leban that comes from the Middle East, which is another fermented milk product, and we have yogurts that come from Europe, and we have cheeses that come from Europe, and we have even some cheeses in India and Mexico and other places. So fermented foods are a very important part, because when I was talking about the life in foods, it's that fermentation, it's those enzymes, and it's the bacteria in the food that really do so much for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they're very important, and they're gaining more importance because up until recently, we Americans have liked really processed dead foods.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The blander, the better.
Yeah, we don't like the sour ones. I'm with you.
Yeah, so in general, we don't like those. So I think, I think that for small children, I think it's really important to give them probiotics.
Mm.
And the reason that I think that is because it sets up their immune system for life.
Mm.
And so I'm a big believer in giving probiotics and for nursing moms to be taking probiotics. I'm also big on giving babies enzymes because I think it also helps enhance their future health overall. In England right now, there's a big study ongoing study with infants, giving them Bifidus infantis from day one,
mm-hmm.
and it's being done in conjunction with a company, a man named Nigel Plummer, who's one of our foremost probiotics authorities and researchers, and it's also being done by him in conjunction with their version of the medical association. And what they're looking for is, do babies that get probiotics from day one, do they have less eczema? Do they have less asthma? Do they have less ongoing health problems as they develop? And we don't have the results from the study yet, but I can tell you from watching the babies I've worked with that the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is yes. And I think that if they follow these children all the way through, we'll see that these children have less arthritis and fewer migraines and a lot of the other problems that are caused from leaky gut and faulty gut microflora.
Yes, I think there's actually some studies on probiotics and the reduction of asthma for mm-hmm. babies taking mm-hmm. probiotics.
Yeah.
When you say babies taking enzymes, are you speaking of actually physically giving them a supplement of a digestive enzyme, or are you talking about a different form of enzyme?
I'm talking about digestive enzymes, giving them a little pinch
mm-hmm.
and having the mom taking them.
Mm-hmm.
Just giving a little pinch on their tongue, it's not, they like it. It tastes sweet and it's not a big deal. At least some of them taste mm-hmm. sweet. And it just kind of, again, it sets up their digestive system to be running really well.
Mm-hmm.
I might not do it with every baby, but the babies that I work with mm-hmm. aren't healthy.
Right, exactly.
And so for babies that aren't thriving, that have failure to thrive, or are not gaining weight, or are sickly, or got just kind of a poor start, or are delayed, like your autistic children that you're working with, or other kids who are developmentally delayed, I think it's really important to start them on digestive enzymes right away.
Yeah, yeah. And in terms of, so for enzymes, what do I want to ask? Oh, I know what I was going to say. In terms of, you were talking about colic earlier, and in your book you say that there's about 16 to 26% of infants experience colic. And beyond, let's say that we tried the probiotics and maybe it helped some, but what other things, food sensitivities, I'm guessing, are a primary thing you think of if the probiotics themselves don't take care of the problem?
Well, usually the probiotics will, but if not, then you start looking at food sensitivities, and you also start using, like for little babies, because colic happens right away.
Mm-hmm.
So you start looking at, if they're breastfed, you start looking at what the mom's eating.
Mm-hmm.
And the mom needs to start taking probiotics and digestive enzymes.
Right.
When my son was, my baby who had eczema, I said to one of my mom's friends, I said, oh, he seems to have a lot of gas. And she looked at me, she goes, gassy mom, gassy baby. Okay? So I was kind of taken back, but the truth is, I probably was a gassy mom. So, because I did have some candidiasis.
Mm.
So when I look back and when I look at the moms I'm working with, if you're breastfeeding, I think it's really important that breastfeeding moms, they start looking, and maybe they take dairy out of their diet and soy out of their diet and broccoli and cabbage family foods out of their diet. And sometimes cucumbers can be really gassy, and sometimes green peppers can be really gassy. And the things that are going to make the mom gassy are probably the things that are going to make the baby gassy.
Hmm.
Sometimes taking gluten-containing grains like wheat and spelt and barley and rye out are important, but usually it's dairy or soy are the biggest ones.
Right.
And then if your baby is bottle fed, probably your baby is reacting to the formula.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a cow-based formula, maybe you want to switch to a soy-based formula. If you've tried both, then maybe you want to switch to a whey-based formula, or maybe you want to even step out on a limb and make your own formula, and there are different recipes that can be made for that. There's one using whole and raw cow's milk on the Weston Price Foundation website.
Mm-hmm, which is a great recipe.
It's a great recipe. I have another one that originally came from Thorne, which is one of the big nutrition companies, and they have one that you can make using one of their protein powders and then adding medium-chain triglycerides and different oils and things to it. And I've used that sometimes with moms who can't breastfeed for one reason or another, or who adopted and don't want to go through the work of trying to lactate when they haven't been pregnant.
Mm-hmm. What's the best way to determine a food sensitivity in an infant? Because doing blood testing won't. I think their system's too young to be able to detect it. But I wasn't sure. Besides dietary testing of taking foods out of the mom's diet, is there any way? I don't know if you ever use a pulse test, or if there's anything specifically you can do to help figure out what things the infant or the baby might be sensitive to.
Well, the pulse test is a good idea, because what happens when we eat a food that we have sensitivities to, that our pulse rate goes up usually 10 or 15 beats a minute within about half an hour after eating that food. Mm. So that would be one way to determine it. I suppose another way would be to do a food sensitivity blood test on a mom.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also, some people are really good at muscle testing or using pendulums or other things. It's not... some people don't consider it to be scientific, but it works.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, if you do that, you don't do it with the baby. You do it with the mom holding the baby, and you test the mom.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, babies are... One of the wonderful things about working with children is that they respond so well.
Mm.
They're really a clean slate.
Right.
And so when a mom changes her diet or you change the formula, usually within a few days, you start seeing a big difference.
Yes.
And so generally you don't really need to do a lot of testing.
Yeah, that is true. They often respond quickly, which is very nice. What about one of the things I see very commonly, and is GERD, is a, you know, reflux in young babies. And can you talk about this? Because you know, one of the things that is so important, like you said, for digestion is the hydrochloric acid in the gut. And I'm trying to figure out what is going on. Why are so many babies coming into my practice with GERD these days?
Well, boy, that's a loaded question. but one of the things is that I do think that they're having food sensitivities. But backing up from that, some babies have birth trauma. And what happens is, as they're coming through the vaginal canal, they get a little bit out of alignment, and they get a little bit of almost a hiatal hernia.
Mm.
And there was a osteopathic physician named Fulford who started doing a very simple adjustment for GERD in babies.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many chiropractors and adjusting osteopaths who know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a very simple thing, and sometimes you can just put it back into place in just one or two sessions.
Wow.
And, for example, I had a little boy I was working with who was doing projectile vomiting all the time and had GERD.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent him to a chiropractor, and within a couple of adjustments, he was fine.
Wow.
So I would say look to the structural reason before you go hunting for everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second thing would be to look for food sensitivities. And again, this is a baby or a small child that would probably really benefit from digestive enzymes,
mm-hmm.
and also from some probiotics.
Right.
You know, always begin with things that are already naturally in the body,
mm-hmm.
Before you start doing other things.
Sure.
And also, nobody's ever really tested babies, but one of the interesting things in adults is that a lot of people who have GERD have low hydrochloric acid levels, not high.
Right.
And I haven't ever really tested children, but I have many clients who are in their 20s who have all these digestive problems. And sometimes you just have to say, well, let's start at the top. Let's start at the stomach and just do a simple self-test for a need for hydrochloric acid. And you have somebody just take some betaine hydrochloric acid. You have them take one capsule, and they swallow it with a meal that has protein. And those of us who have normal hydrochloric acid levels, it should feel like heartburn or a little burning or discomfort. Mm-hmm. Then we know, well, I already have enough. This is the end of this experiment. But I have clients in their 20s, in their early 20s, some of them, who will take 5, 6, 7 hydrochloric acid tablets with a meal and not feel any burn.
Wow.
And so I wonder if some of these babies who don't have who have GERD also don't have enough hydrochloric acid. If they're on a good digestive enzyme that's from a plant base, it's aspergillus base.
Mm-hmm.
The aspergillus base plant enzymes work in the pH of the stomach, whereas pancreatic based ones don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would work really well to help them start digesting and helping them. Give them the support so that they can develop so that their parietal cells will be able to make hydrochloric acid. And then there's all kinds of, like, fun little things that you can do that are more traditional with babies who have GERD. And one of the European remedies has always been fennel tea for babies.
Mm.
And fennel tastes really yummy, and it's very settling to the digestive system of babies. Another one, it worked for Peter Rabbit, so chamomile. You know, it's another really good one to try for babies. They're really soothing and they're mild and they taste okay. And if you give a little bit in a bottle, they'll drink it.
Mm.
And for babies that are even a little bit bigger, 6 or 8 months, you can give them a little sippy cup and they like playing with those.
Right.
They really like feeding themselves.
Yes, definitely. And in terms of, what do you find more in your practice for children? Is it constipation or diarrhea?
I find both.
Okay.
I find both. And, you know, sometimes they both have the same cause. Again, not everybody can tolerate dairy products, but children who can tolerate dairy products, yogurt and kefir are really good foods for them because yogurt and kefir both have good probiotics that help. They really balance either constipation or diarrhea.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also get kids with, they tend to have constipation and tummy upsets. Mm-hmm. In children, I think it's the statistics are something like 13% of our small children, elementary school age, have irritable bowel syndrome, and 17% of our high schoolers.
Wow.
Have irritable bowel syndrome. And in the population, adult population, it's about 12%. And the interesting thing about kids, especially little kids, is that they display it not so much as constipation or diarrhea, although they can have those. What they say is, my tummy hurts.
Mm.
And in children, they call it recurring abdominal pain, RAP. It's different from the music. And you see that a lot in little kids. My tummy hurts.
Mm.
Or they won't want to eat because their tummy hurts.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want to eat if my tummy hurt.
Right.
And so it's an interesting, it's very interesting watching it. Again, a lot of kids aren't getting enough fiber in their diet, so that helps them tend to be more constipated. If they don't have the right bacteria, they'll be more constipated. And a lot of kids have diarrhea because they've been on antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most common reason.
Right.
And a child who has recurring, like, ear infections, you want to check out food allergies, the most common one being dairy.
Yes.
I once had a mom come into my office, and she had two little boys. I think they were, like, 3 and 5. And one had had 2 sets of tubes in his ears, and one had had 3.
Hmm.
And I said, just take them off of dairy and see how they do. And they both did great. Now, not everybody's that easy, but but they both did really amazing. And so when you see a child with repeated ear infections, suspect dairy or wheat or soy.
Yes.
Those are the big ones. Corn sometimes, too.
Yes.
The little kids aren't eating that much corn unless they're getting a lot of corn products in their food.
Mm-hmm. Boy, in our last few minutes, is there anything else you'd just like to say about your book, Digestive Wellness for Children, or any, I don't know, key points that you'd like to get across to parents that might be listening?
Yeah, actually I would. One of the things I'd like to point out is that there are a lot of health issues that we would never think of that are digestive, that when digestion isn't working right, that they they present themselves. So if you have a child who has arthritis, juvenile arthritis, or asthma, or learning or behavior problems, or is autistic, as we talked about, or diabetic, or with Down syndrome, or has migraines, those all can really benefit from digestive support.
Mm.
And because we didn't even talk about leaky gut syndrome, but when food molecules that are too big for the cells to utilize, when they actually slip into the bloodstream, they're screaming and saying, I need nutrients and I need energy and I need protein and I need fat, I need all these things. And the bloodstream can't digest them. So then we start getting these immune reactions. And the immune reactions can show up as pain or inflammation anywhere in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when we think digestion, we have to think systemic illness. And I love to quote Abram Hoffer, who's one of our wonderful psychiatrists who practices nutritional medicine. And what he has been saying for a long time, one of his quotes is, if the patient has been to more than 8 doctors, nutrition is probably the medical answer.
Wow. That's very interesting. I would.
You know. Yeah. So, you know, we are what we eat. We're also what we can absorb and digest. And if we can't do that, then we don't feel good. And our kids don't either.
Mm-hmm.
Is it any wonder they have learning and behavior problems and are depressed? And depression, too. Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
So many children who are depressed.
I know, and it's so sad. It's a really difficult one. But yeah, I'm glad that you're bringing all of this important information to the public, because I think that so many kids can really benefit before having to go down this long, long, long line of medical intervention when digestion and food and nutrition and all that might really make a huge difference. So thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Let me just give out my website.
Please.
If people want to, I have all kinds of free goodies there, a free ebook and free weekly health tips, and also some more information about the book, both of my books. So my website is innovativehealing.com.
Great. Okay, Liz, thanks again.
Thank you so much, Julie.
All
thanks
right.
For having me on.
Absolutely. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Bye. You are listening to KPOO San Francisco 89.5 FM, and you have been listening to Julie Matthews. I'm a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living, and we had on today Liz Lipsky of Digestive Wellness for Children. Check out her new book, and you can find out more about her book and her other books at her website, innovativehealing.com. You can listen to our radio show, Reality Sandwich, every Thursday at noon, and any past shows on our website, realitysandwichradio.com. And you can find out more about me, Julie Matthews, and my services at healthfulliving.org. Stay tuned every Thursday at noon for more Reality Sandwich. And up next is Connecting the Dots. Thanks for listening.
I saw a rainbow just earlier today. Lately those rainbows